Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott. Hi, everybody. Here is what's ahead this hour. Moments from now, we'll speak with Dallas Fed President Robert Kaplan about the recovery, the markets, and the Fed's messaging. Stimulus talks driving stocks once again. Markets on pace for their first down month since March, but we're closing out on a hopeful note. And Walmart's redesign, here comes Palantir and Bundle Up China. That's all ahead, but we begin with the markets. Quite a rally building this afternoon. Seema Modi is here with the numbers for us. Seema.
Kelly Evans, good afternoon. Yeah, those stimulus talks remain front and center, especially those encouraging comments from Secretary Treasury Steven Mnuchin. We're looking at the Dow Industrials, currently up about 493. At the highs of the day, we were up 514. So just off the highs of the day, the S&P 500 up 45 points and the Nasdaq higher by 1.3%. That said, all major averages are set to post monthly declines for the first time since March. Among the leaders on the Dow and the S&P today is Salesforce. In the news today, after launching a vaccine distribution platform, it's also one of the few competitors to Palantir after it acquired Tableau for $16 billion, shares up about 2%. But despite today's gain, Salesforce was actually the Dow's worst performer this month, responsible for about 130 points of the Dow's losses. Now, as for the third quarter coming to a close, the S&P is set to post around a 9% gain from a sector perspective. As you can see right here, big winner, consumer discretionary, up 16%. Biggest loser, energy, continuing to be the dog, not just for the quarter, but for the year, down 20%. Kelly, back to you.
Yeah, it's been such a rough go there lately. Seema, thank you very much. Now, at its most recent meeting, the Federal Reserve signaled no new interest rate hikes until at least 2023. That statement got two dissents from the committee, including one from our next guest, who said that he would have preferred the Fed retain greater policy rate flexibility. Let's welcome in CNBC senior economics reporter Steve Leisman with a CNBC exclusive interview with Dallas Fed President Robert Kaplan. Steve.
Kelly, thanks very much. President Kaplan, thanks for joining us. I want to start where Kelly suggested, which is on the dissent, and two particular aspects of the dissent I want to ask you about. The first is your concern about excessive risk-taking. Seems like a good question on a day when the market's up 461 points, it looks like, on my screen right now. How much concern do you have that the Fed's promises to remain accommodative for many, many years could engender excessive risk-taking in the stock market and in the bond market?
Yeah, I'm generally worried that if we keep rates at zero for longer than we have to, that it forces people out on the risk curve and they've got to take more risk. You can't have money in savings. You can't have money in bonds by and large, especially shorter bonds. And I think we saw a little bit of this in March, in that part of the sell-off in March was COVID-related and lockdown-related, but part of it was some forced selling in risk markets because people had too much risk on. And that's what happens, and that's the danger. If you go for a prolonged period of time and you get excess risk-taking, when the markets do go down, it could be more severe and destabilizing.
Is there a concern about that right now, given the levels of the market?
I'm not worried about monetary policy or the things we're doing. Obviously, we're doing extraordinary actions, not just the Fed funds rate, but also what we're doing with the 13-3 programs and asset buying. But we need to, because it's a crisis. And so I think we're going to need to keep the Fed funds rate at zero. I've said publicly for the next probably 2.5 to 3 years, could be that long, until we get on track to have weathered the crisis and are on track to meet our full employment and price stability goals. My dissent is about making commitments beyond that point, and that I think beyond that point, I'd rather see us keep some flexibility.
So let me follow up on that. When people tune into Kelly Evans and the Exchange, they know they're going to get a serious discussion of Federal Reserve policy. So, President Kaplan, can you explain your notion in your dissent or in the essay you wrote about your dissent? How it is that the Fed, yeah, if it stays at zero while the economy improves, the Fed actually becomes more accommodative as the economy improves. How does that work?
Yeah, so what happens in the midst, in the height of the COVID pandemic, the neutral rate, the equilibrium interest rate, drops. And so we said pre-pandemic that maybe the neutral rate, the equilibrium Fed funds rate, was something like, say, 2.25% to 2.5%. What happens when you have a severe downturn is it drops. And so what that means is the Fed's got to really take extraordinary action, and we did, to drop rates to zero and do other things in order to create accommodation to help us dig out of this this hole that's been dug because of the pandemic. As we approach, though, ideally over the next 2 or 3 years, as we start approaching, though, full employment and price stability, as we start approaching our 2% target, the neutral rate, as we recover, is going to start drifting up again. And in fact, you saw in the summary of economic projections that each of us submitted this last meeting, I think the median estimate for the neutral rate longer term is something like 2.5%. So to your point, if you keep rates at zero as you're approaching full employment, it's a little bit analogous to not only are we not taking our foot off the accelerator, but we're actually depressing the accelerator and increasing accommodation as we move toward meeting our dual mandated goals. And what I'm saying is, I don't know if that's going to be appropriate. Historically, it wouldn't have been. With the new framework and our inflation targets, I think we're going to be more accommodative than we have been in the past. But I don't know if we want to be committing to keeping rates at zero until we meet these targets, because the amount of accommodation is going to be widening. And I don't know if that's going to be appropriate.
Thanks.
That makes a lot of sense, Mr. Kaplan. It's Kelly here, and we appreciate the explanation. It raises the market's broader question about the Fed's communication here and what's going to happen over the next few years. So your colleague Charles Evans last week said, you know, we could raise rates before inflation hit 2%. Meanwhile, Neel Kashkari, who was also a dissenter from the decision last month, is in favor of something very different, where, you know, we would see the inflation numbers at 2%, maybe higher than 2%, before we start to have that discussion. And maybe we need a more clear framework for Wall Street or for investors about what those numbers and those metrics are. Would you be open to that kind of clarity? And how would you account for all of these different viewpoints coming from a Fed that is supposed to kind of be committed to this important new goal?
Okay. So first of all, one of the good things about the Fed, which I hope remains, is disagreement and debate and airing it publicly. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's a healthy thing, and I think we make better decisions. In terms of clarity, I think the markets and the public have pretty good clarity right now. The markets expect that the Fed funds rate is going to stay at zero probably until 2023. The summary of economic projections we just submitted, the median dot among Fed presidents was zero through 2023. I'm a former business person. I think that's pretty good clarity. If there's a debate that we're having about what we're going to do beyond that point, I think it's reasonable to be debating that. I hope we continue to debate that. I think it's a healthy thing, and I don't think there's a lack of clarity, at least among financial market participants and business people, as to where the Fed is heading for the next 2.5-3 years. Understanding it's hard to predict what's going to happen a year or two from now. We pretty much made a pretty good commitment and indication we're going to stay at zero for the next few years. That's pretty good clarity from my taste.
So, President Kaplan, is a great setup for the next question, which is, can you predict what's going to happen in the next week or two? And in that regard, I mean, does the economy need additional fiscal stimulus? If it doesn't get it, does that mean the Fed has to do more? And what more can the Fed do? And I'm sorry to ask such a long question, but we are indeed tight on time.
That's okay. The we do need additional fiscal stimulus. One of the unusual things about this pandemic has been consumer income and consumer spending has stayed resilient. The big part of big reason why is fiscal support. And so I think it would create downside risks if we weren't going to get that fiscal support. And the fact is, lack of fiscal support to bolster incomes isn't really the kind of thing the Fed can make up for. We can facilitate easier financial conditions, help borrowing, but a loss of income is really fiscal policy is the primary vehicle to address that. And I think we need additional fiscal policy.
Very good. We'll leave it there with that clarity, as promised. Robert Kaplan and our own Steve Liesman, thank you both very much. Steve, love the shout out. Thank you, sir. We're going to hear from another Fed president later today as well. Mary Daly of the San Francisco Fed will join Closing Bell for an exclusive interview at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Don't miss it. Meantime, the markets are wrapping up what looks to be their worst September performance in nearly a decade. But they're getting a boost today on improving odds of that stimulus package Mr. Kaplan just referenced. Here's what the Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said this morning at our Delivering Alpha conference. Listen.
I think we're very effective in communicating with each other. In many cases, we do have things that we agree on, and we have things that there are differences. And we're trying to see if both of us can manage a package that gets some of what everybody wants. We're going to give it one more serious try to get this done, and I think we're hopeful that we can get something done. I think there's a reasonable compromise here. It's something that the president very much wants to get done and make sure that we help those parts of the economy that still need help.
It's enough for about a 500-point gain in the markets this afternoon. For more, I'm joined by Andres Garcia Amaya, who is the CEO of Zoe Financial, and Tracy McMillian, who's head of Global Asset Allocation Strategy at Wells Fargo Investment Institute. It's good to have you both here. So, Andres, I'm being a little cheeky, but plenty of people in the market are citing Mnuchin's comments for why we've seen this rebound today. Is that reading too much into it? And how do the forces from the Fed discussion that we just had to the debate last night factor into all of that, do you think?
Yeah, so if you look at monetary policy, I listened to the interview, and I think they've done a really good job of communicating. I mean, you could pinpoint maybe 2-3 years out if there's some disagreements, but I don't think the market expects the Fed to make any drastic changes. So from that perspective, boring is good on the monetary policy right now. On the fiscal side, I do think that the market's looking for more clarity out of fiscal policy. If we know what the next aid looks like and it passes, I think that is one less wrinkle, one less uncertainty when it comes to the equation. And then lastly, it really comes down to, is the economy starting to continue to see improvement and therefore earning revisions continue to see improvement? And so far, those two have held up.
Yeah, and Tracy, I know you also were citing the Treasury Secretary's comments, and it's interesting to hear people try to piece this all together. They go, well, maybe, you know, after the debate, the Treasury Secretary felt he had to come out and say something more forceful on the COVID front for markets. I mean, I don't know about the cause and effect there, but would you place a lot of emphasis on his remarks, given that most of the DC types we talk to say they don't think there's much hope of a stimulus package this year?
Well, clearly from his comments this morning, he did feel like there is a possibility that we could see that package come through, possibly even before the election. And certainly the markets are reacting to that today. And they think that there's a possibility, at least the two sides seem to be getting closer together. And, you know, there's also a lot of positive economic news out today. And we think that's also contributing to market gains as well.
Yeah, we've got pending home sales. It was pretty good. The ADP jobs report was pretty good. I mean, there are, like you said, Tracy, some positive signs out there. I want to ask you about your recommendation for high yield bonds. We've seen higher than expected defaults in that space. We've been following it for the last couple of weeks to see, you know, what those stresses look like. Why do you think that that's a place investors should look right now, along with commodities and gold?
You know, Mr. Kaplan was just speaking about holding interest rates at 0% for 2 to 3 years. And if investors are going to be faced with 0% on their cash accounts and, you know, maybe 70 basis points on 10-year treasuries, maybe a percent on 10-year treasuries, they're really going to have to look for other places to meet their long-term return expectations and their long-term yield needs. So we are suggesting that investors move some of their investment grade fixed income into high yield. Not all, of course, we maintain a diversified portfolio, but we are moving up in risk assets in our fixed income allocations.
All right, Andres, what would you recommend? And, you know, we have these dual tracks. We have the stimulus hopes on the one hand, which, again, to me seem pretty faint for the near term. On the other hand, we have the Fed. And last week, the message was the Fed's a big disappointment and its confusion is all over the place. I don't know if that's changed or if it's just, you know, as long as the trade's moving forward on one of those tracks, is the market all right? What do you think?
Yeah. So to take a step back, if you're trying to generate some type of return over the next couple of years, it is very hard to make an argument that you need to hide in fixed income, right? I mean, the biggest driver of returns in fixed income is where the rate is right now, right? And that's not promising, both in long-term bonds as well as short-term bonds. So I think you do need some equity exposure. And guess what? That comes with more uncertainty and more risk, but that has always been the case. Yes, we have elections coming up in a couple of weeks, but I think the biggest mistake is we hear this all the time with potential clients saying, I'm going to sit this out until after the election. Well, what are they waiting for? Right? Whatever happens with the elections, we've had many of them. The markets will continue to be driven by earnings. They'll continue to be driven by the economy, which is mostly the private sector.
All right. Fair enough. Andres Garcia, my Tracy McMillian, thank you both. We appreciate it today, digesting these markets on a lot of news over the past 24 hours, that's for sure. Coming up, we are still waiting for Palantir to open for trading today. It's one of the most highly anticipated debuts. They're doing it as a direct listing. We're going to monitor it and speak with the CEO as soon as this occurs. You can see the pricing range narrowing to around the $10 mark, but we'll have a whole lot more on that for you. Plus, Tesla may have achieved a new milestone this month. We have the full details on that. And some big layoffs combined with some better than expected jobs news. It's all ahead on The Exchange. Stay with us.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
The key to America's economic comeback is jobs, and this week we've had two different pictures of where we stand on that front. On one side, layoffs are piling up. Airlines could furlough tens of thousands of workers starting tomorrow without federal aid. Disney announcing it will cut 28,000 jobs in its parks division. Shell saying it will lose 9,000 jobs in Marathon Petroleum and Dow, both announcing restructuring plans that include job cuts. Doesn't sound so great. But on the flip side, data from ADP today painting a different picture. The payroll firm saying the U.S. added a better than expected 749,000 jobs last month, while August was revised up too. Now, the gains were widespread between small and large companies. And we have more jobs data on tap this week. Jobless claims are set to be released tomorrow and the official September jobs report on Friday. Economists are expecting non-farm payrolls to rise by 800,000 and the unemployment rate to fall to 8.2%. They're also expecting a small gain in average hourly wages. Still, what's the bigger tell, the jobs reports from the past month or the new layoffs we've had this week? Well, that only time will tell. Coming up, Cowen says bundle up. They say the firm that Canada Goose is ready to take flight, and there's a China angle to it that we'll tell you about. Plus, New York office workers are returning at a much slower pace than in other big cities. The details and the potential domino effect. Remember, you can always watch or listen to us live on the go on the CNBC app. The Exchange is back in a couple.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Let's get you caught up to speed on these markets right now. The Dow's up 445 points. Up at the highs, we're up 514, so we're about 70 points off of that level right now. Still a nice 1.6% gain, and all the averages are higher. The Dow is the best. The S&P's up 1.2%, the NASDAQ up 1.1%. All 11 sectors are in the green today. Check out this leadership. It's healthcare and financials. Consumer staples are up there as well. And let's go back to some of those Dow movers which are powering the blue chips higher today. Boeing, American Express, and United Health moving higher in the range of 3%. Disney is the biggest and I think the only laggard right now, down 0.5% after announcing some major layoffs. Let's get to Sue Herrera now for our CNBC News update. Hi, Sue.
Hello, Kelly. Hello, everybody. Here's what's happening at this hour. In Wisconsin, Republicans are asking a federal court to put on hold a ruling allowing ballots in that state to be counted for 6 days after the election. Attorneys for the state legislature says that the ruling could lead to voter confusion during the presidential election. A new study of hydroxychloroquine shows that that drug was not effective in preventing COVID-19 infections. Researchers gave healthcare workers an 8-week course of the drug, but found no decrease in coronavirus cases. Off the coast of Spain, government chase boats intercepting a yacht loaded with marijuana. A total of 35 tons of marijuana was confiscated from a total of 4 boats. And back here at home in Rhode Island, therapy dogs are among the latest to return to their workplaces. For the first time in months, they're visiting patients, even if it's only through a window. Their job is to boost morale, reduce stress for everybody involved at the hospital. Okay. Everybody go aw. That's your news update, Kel. I'll send it back to you.
Those are some very handsome dogs.
Indeed, they are.
I'll take a few of those out of my window. Sue, thank you very much.
You got it.
Sue Herrera. We are awaiting Palantir's first trade in its direct listing today. Yes, it's been taking a while, but remember, there were two big direct listings. First, Asana, now Palantir. It's only two out of, I think, 4 that we've ever had. So the fact that two are coming on the same day with the same book runners tells you that there is going to be some, take some time for them to sort through this process. The reference price, $7.25, looks like it's somewhere in the $10 range right now as they continue to try to match supply and demand. And Andrew Ross Sorkin will interview the CEO of Palantir, Alex Karp, as soon as that stock does open. So stay tuned for that. And still ahead, Goose gets a boost, Walmart's revamp, Tesla's new record, and Schoolcation. All that and more is ahead on today's edition of Rapid Fire right after this. Stay with us. Welcome back. Let's catch you up on a few stories that should be on your radar today. It is time for Rapid Fire. Here to break down the headlines, I welcome Michael Santoli, Seema Modi, and Robert Frank. First up, Canada Goose could take flight thanks in part to Chinese demand. Cowen upgrading the stock to outperform, boosting the price target to 36 today. That's the second highest on the street. They say Canada Goose has a golden opportunity in the China market, where it is uniquely positioned. The call is boosting shares to the tune of about 6% today, building on a 140% rally off of the low. So, guys, what do we think? I mean, it's also interesting to me that this comes on the same day that the service number for the China PMI, Seema, was pretty strong. Are they placing too much on Chinese demand, or is actually that economy doing better than we would have thought?
Well, the data you just pointed to does suggest that China's economy is in rebound mode. Now, to Canada Goose and its ability to grow its market share in China, remember when the company went public, Kelly, there were all these concerns about a Chinese boycott because of the arrest of a Huawei executive. That really didn't pan out into anything, and that certainly did not stop the luxury retailer from investing in China and expanding its retail footprint, now on track to open a couple of, it looks like, 8 to 10 more stores by the end of this year. I'm very curious, though, that even amidst a pandemic, there's fewer social opportunities to go outside. There's, people are still investing in a pretty expensive coat, but clearly there's demand.
Yeah, that's true. Mike, what do you make of the stock?
I mean, it had a tremendous decline off those highs a couple years ago, as you might imagine. It has come back okay. I was actually surprised to see the valuation-wise, if we're talking about, you know, the next fiscal year's earnings. It's really not all that extended given the fast growth rate, a little bit over 20 times. So it seems kind of interesting in the rationale as well. Although one piece of it that I guess you could debate is this idea that form over function is going to be a dominant mode in fashion once people get to this post-pandemic. Who knows? Maybe everyone's going to want to be frivolous and we don't really care about whether this stuff is functional or not.
Yeah, I actually would say I think people want to be frivolous. I mean, yeah. Form over function, I think that's more post-apocalyptic than post-pandemic, but that's a different discussion. Robert, I was going to say to you, since you got your finger on the pulse always, is Canada Goose still like the sought-after status item, or has it been dethroned?
It's a very high status brand in China, and they're right. Look, the luxury brands that will succeed in the next 10 years are those brands that can sell to young Chinese consumers in China. The whole game of selling goods outside of China to Chinese tourists, that's gone. The problem for Canada Goose is all the imitation and fake products in China. Today, you can go on Alibaba and get a China Goose jacket. Looks the same logo, except it says China Goose on it. And it's $58 compared to the $900 real jacket. So that's going to be their challenge.
Yeah, I wear a knockoff from Modell's. This analyst is saying they expect China is going to be more than 50% of EPS over time. So I think it goes back to Seema's point that, you know, it's interesting the time we're talking about this Cold War with China, that Canada Goose can just fly under the radar. Ha! But for now...
But Robert, is there actually a bird called the China Goose? I mean, that's, you know, a little bit of a well, miss on the counter.
Yeah, it's funny because it's the same logo, but it's got a picture of China on the brand, on the actual logo. So it's a very pro-China thing. And again, I mean, these are hugely popular, and there are about 8 or 10 other knockoffs that are similar and much cheaper than that. And it's hard to police in China.
Amen. All right, let's turn to China. Let's turn to Tesla, who has some news today about production demand that we probably should hit. The news outlet Electric is reporting that Tesla is on track to achieve record delivery volume this quarter. Now, to do that, Tesla would have to surpass 112,000 deliveries, the highest level that Tesla hit in the fourth quarter of 2019. Shares of Tesla are up about 2% today. We're expecting to get the company's third quarter delivery and production results at the end of this week. Wall Street Guys is expecting 140,000 vehicles delivered. Seema, what do you make of it?
Well, Elon Musk has a history of over-promising and under-delivering when it comes to delivery and timeline. With that said, in his defense, it's been a really tough year. He himself called this quarter definitely one of the toughest quarters in global logistics. But just given the competition out there, not just domestically but overseas in China, there is this impetus to move fast and to deliver these big numbers that Wall Street really wants, especially given the recent pressure the stock has fallen under.
Yeah. And Mike, there was a lot of buildup as to whether Tesla would be included in the S&P 500. And some say that's even why Elon was pushing so hard for them to be profitable for four quarters and that sort of thing. Yep. Now that they've been passed over, do you expect them to keep pushing the pedal to the metal, so to speak?
Interesting. I don't know exactly. I mean, presumably, yes, they would want to show profitability. But once you've qualified on the four quarters of net income, as you have to be considered for the S&P 500, I'm not sure you have to kind of restart that if you have a loss-making quarter. So I don't know if the stakes are as high. And also, across the board, I think Tesla has kind of succeeded in lowering the stakes when it comes to the quarterly delivery numbers. I mean, they say we might have a record quarter. Well, that leaves a lot of room for disappointment relative to what Wall Street's looking for, because Wall Street's looking for 140,000. A record would be 112,001. So that doesn't tell you very much. And we're supposed to be doing 500,000 units this year. By the way, originally that was the goal for 2018. And I've looked at some Wall Street estimates that say, oh, we're assuming that they get to 2.5 million cars in 5 years, and assuming great profit margins, you discount it back, the stock's fairly valued today. So I don't think the production numbers is really what this stock is trading on right now.
But that's a funny point that they're saying, yeah, it's going to be a record, just give themselves 28,000 you know, vehicles worth of cushion. I'm not saying that's why they're doing it. You could also argue they should always be doing a record, you know, record production numbers, but obviously it's a little bit of a seasonal business. All right, let's turn to Walmart, which is taking a page of all things from the airport in its new store redesign, which is rolling out in nearly 1,200 supercenters by the end of next fiscal year. The revamped stores will have a new look and focus on navigating large groups of people throughout the store, as well as incorporating the Walmart app and contactless checkout. So Walmart is basically saying, Robert, that COVID is changing how people want to shop. But it's one thing to say, hey, this is happening for the next few months. It's another thing to redesign your stores around it.
Yeah, look, it's a great thing. And what they're really saying is they had designed stores, including in 2017 when Target did a redesign, to incorporate what they call more serendipity into your shopping experience, which means that they made it a giant corn maze of consumerism where you would go in and deliberately get lost and buy so much stuff that that was the only way out. What they're saying now is we're going to make it easier to find stuff. So the electronics aisle will be labeled electronics, baby products there. So I think it's a great change. I don't know about you, Kelly, and guys, I haven't been in a store that's not a grocery store. I've only been in one store since March. That was to get a vacuum cleaner that I ordered online and just went to pick up at Target. That's the only store I've been to, and it's fine. I don't need to go.
I've been to Target as well. It's been the grocery store. It's been Target, maybe Home Depot, SEMA. But Robert, my favorite phrase was the corn maze of capitalism, the giant corn maze of capitalism that describes the former layout of these stores. So SEMA, I mean, here's a question. If that was working for them in terms of the business model in the past, if they lose some of that serendipity, that whole, hey, I got lost in Target, so I bought another Magnolia candle and pillow, you know, I mean, granted, we're talking about Walmart here, but are they going to give up some profit?
Or does it allow them to get more people in the door, maybe a newer clientele that they hadn't had access to in the past, because now the store is getting revamped, it's easier to get through, that efficiency is now being tied to the Walmart experience. I don't know, it could certainly work. If you just look at what Walmart has done over the past couple of months, it seems like it's really trying to think more about technology, whether it's the launch of Walmart Plus to compete with Amazon, this potential deal with TikTok. You got to wonder if CEO Doug McMillon really trying to transform Walmart. It's no longer your father's Walmart. At least that doesn't seem to be the case.
All right. Let's move on. Talk about some New York City being the capital of work from home. Only 10% of New York City office workers are back as of September 18th, according to new data. So 10% in New York City, but about 25% of U.S. office workers in general have returned as of September. And Dallas and Los Angeles are some standouts, with 40% and 32% of workers back in the office, respectively. Now, New York City suburbs are up in this range at about 32%, Mike. But this has big implications for the future of New York City.
Yeah, it does. Certainly, if this doesn't change, if we don't get some kind of advance that's going to allow people to feel comfortable going into a vertical city where hundreds of thousands of people typically had converged on it to work through public transportation. So those two things to me are the main things holding back any more return to normalcy in terms of volumes of people going back to the office.
Yeah.
It's the elevators, it's the trains, and also it's just a sort of a bias against testing these limits just because it's been so hard in the spring.
Let me throw a curveball here, guys. Palantir is open for trading. Let's show on the screen what exactly is happening here. Again, as I mentioned, the reference price last night was $7.25. Looked like it was going to open around $10. We're at $10.50 right now, so about a 45% gain for Palantir. Again, this is a direct listing. It is the second direct listing today. Asana was the other one. Morgan Stanley and Citadel are the book runners. They're working on these direct listings for both companies. They often take longer than the typical IPO process to find a buyer because they're not working the night before to make sure that there's kind of that book of demand lined up and ready to go. So again, not necessarily raising new capital for the company, allowing existing workers and shareholders to cash out. And so the shares are up 42% on what's been a long but not unexpectedly long process to get this stock open today. We are actually going to be hearing directly from the CEO of Palantir in just a couple of minutes' time. He'll be joining Andrew Ross Sorkin in a first on CNBC interview. In the meantime, we have Ed Lee standing by with a little bit of reaction. I'm sorry, Leslie, whose name sounds like Ed Lee, and we'll be hearing from later on. Leslie Picker is standing by with some reaction to the stock opening here. Leslie?
I have the Lee part of the Ed Lee with Leslie. But no, opening at $10 a share, that's above the reference price. But it's important to note that what a reference price means for a direct listing is not where investors received allocation in an IPO. That's essentially looking at kind of the average trading going on in the private secondary markets to determine that. So it's incorrect to necessarily say it's up from its reference price because money wasn't exchanged hands in the way that an IPO would be allocated at that price. $10 a share is where Morgan Stanley, according to the Wall Street Journal, was informing investors kind of expect a floor around $10 a share. That story was published last week implying a $22 billion valuation on a fully diluted basis. So this seems kind of in line with what they were communicating to investors, according to the Wall Street Journal sources, with regard to where this thing could open for trading today. What will be worth following up on is where it closes today relative to that $10 per share opening figure. Right now, we're looking like, you know, 40 cents above that, 50 cents above that. So that will be worth paying attention to, as well as the volume, as well as the float. Because one interesting thing to note with this direct listing compared to previous direct listings of Spotify and Slack is that they actually do have a lockup. So that is one of the big risk factors for a direct listing is previously they haven't had these lockups. So it's a little uncertain who might sell on the first day of trading because the company's not issuing any primary stock. So it's all dependent on current investors to be willing to sell their shares, and that market has to be the right price for them to actually do so. Well, Palantir did things a little bit differently. They actually locked up about 80% of current investors' shares, so only 20% became available to trade today, which could impact the kind of the supply-demand dynamics that you see with traditional IPOs, Kelly.
Yeah. Leslie, stay with us. I want to turn to Mr. Ed Lee, as mentioned now. So $10 opening price, Ed, gives this company a $22 billion valuation. What do you think are the most important questions for the CEO here? Leslie also mentioned the lockup period, so that could be considered one overhang on the stock for the next few months. Oh, we lost Ed. Mike Santoli, I'll turn back to you. Same question. What do you make of the open and the fact that there is a lockup?
Yeah, I think it's roughly on target. I think you would probably consider this a success if you want to just look at the process in terms of how direct listings work. You don't necessarily want to see it really fall through that kind of benchmark price that the advisors were looking for. But you also don't tend to see that kind of the energy built up for some kind of a pop because you weren't trying to sort of get more demand than really was able to be supplied with the offering. So it seems like it's pretty much on target. $22 billion, it's kind of fascinating because it's a relatively mature business. It almost doesn't seem that big anymore. I mean, I know that's kind of telling you something about where we are in this cycle of these companies, like in the Snowflake world and everything else. But it is something that seems like you would have to say, okay, this more or less went according to script.
Ed Lee, third time's a charm, sir. Give us your reaction here as the stock opens for trading.
I mean, it's a nice price. I mean, I think that's what they were hoping for. They were looking for the $10 range. So I guess you could chalk it up to, you know what, the direct listing, at least in this case, is not a bad call. It sort of worked to their favor. I'm actually a little bit surprised that investors have this much appetite for a company that has such an unusual control structure. I mean, of course, they got this far, so you figure there's some value into their management and their control. But longer term, I don't know. I would want more ownership of the voting rights, really, ultimately. And that's still an overhang.
Yeah, Leslie, I wonder, Leslie, if it's a difference of business model. I mean, Palantir does a lot of business with the government, and in some ways that business seems more steady, more reliable than it would if it were, say, a consumer app.
That's certainly true. However, it also calls attention to certain reputational risks that this company might face. Amnesty International out with the report yesterday or the day before, basically raising questions as to whether their work with the government, particularly with ICE, is creating some sort of human rights abuses as it pertains to people who are seeking asylum in this country. We reached out to Palantir for comment on that several times. They have yet to respond to our request seeking comment. But it certainly raises the question from a reputational standpoint. Yes, it's stickier income, perhaps, because it's something where, you know, they go to the government starts to rely on their software to do business. It can be stickier. They value those contracts at $1.2 billion for doing business with the U.S. government and with its allies. But that said, you still kind of have that reputational overhang with as it pertains to privacy, as it pertains to human rights. And so those are two things that you kind of have to balance when you look at this company.
Yeah, Ed, I'll give you the final word here. On the maybe the direct listing model. So we've had about four major direct listings now, two of them today, Asana and Palantir, the other 2 months back, Slack and Spotify. What do you think this is going to do for using this as a way for other companies to pursue going public now?
I mean, look, there's less friction, right? And it's better for current shareholders and, you know, you're not paying these banking fees. And I think that the fact that there's so much hunger for new issues right now in a low interest rate environment, we're living in this new Powell mandate world where interest rates will stay low for a while, even if employment starts to unemployment starts to creep downward. So it's to your benefit, right? You might as well take that route as long as you don't have to raise money. And I think, you know, that hunger, that appetite is something they could certainly play to. One other point, what Leslie said, I completely agree that there's this nice aspect where they've got built-in contracts with government, but it's a little bit like the military-industrial complex, right, where, I don't know, what if the Pentagon says, well, hey, Palantir, you need to be exclusive to us now. You can't sell your services to other companies, other private entities. So that's the other side of that coin, and that's another potential overhang, I think.
Fair enough. Still, investors looking past it for the time being. The share's up 55% from their reference price. They're over $11 in trading, which began just a couple of minutes ago. Leslie Picker, Ed Lee, thank you guys. And to all of our rapid-fire panelists, thank you very much as well. It went in a different direction than we thought, but it was fiery. Still ahead, shares of Palantir are finally open for trading, and Andrew Ross Sorkin will speak with the CEO in a first on CNBC interview. But first, our own Shepard Smith will join us ahead of the debut of his new show, The News with Shepard Smith, tonight at 7 p.m. He'll tell us the big-name guest joining him. The Exchange is back in 2 minutes. Welcome back. Let's check in on shares of Palantir just a couple of moments into its debut as a public company. They went the direct listing route. They're up 54% right now from the reference price that was set last night. That was $7.25 a share. We opened at 10, but we've climbed from there. We're up at more than $11 for Palantir, as I mentioned, about a 53% gain. Coming up here, Shepard Smith will join us ahead of the debut of The News with Shepard Smith tonight on CNBC at 7 p.m. He'll tell us what to expect when we come right back. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to The Exchange. It's a big day here at CNBC as we launch our new show at 7 p.m., The News with Shepard Smith. Shep joins me now. In fact, Shep, you and the team have been working around the clock. You took Sandy. No, you've been working around the clock for the show launch, and what a day to launch. There's no shortage of news I know you guys are going to be exploring. And we just got news from the commission on presidential debates. They might be changing the debate. Listen, you guys talked about that this morning, so we're not going to go back into that. I want to know what's on your mind for tonight.
Well, I think that debate, frankly, the debate's on our mind and what it means going forward. You mentioned the Commission on Presidential Debates. They've just announced that they're going to make changes to the format going forward because they've come to realize that the debates need a little more structure. It's been described in many different ways. Vice President Biden, that is, declared it today a national embarrassment. Think of it what you will. It's part of the news tonight. We'll have a presidential historian on, NBC News' presidential historian, Michael Beschloss. So we'll talk about that and politics as we head toward the vote. We'll have a lot of coverage on COVID. It's surging in many parts of the nation right now, Kelly. here in New York City. We're starting indoor dining, and we've got a surge happening in the outer boroughs, in Brooklyn and Queens. So it's all coming together in the fall. The doctors have been telling us that COVID is going to surge come the fall. And sure enough, it looks like there are signs, at least, that it may be upon us.
I know, and I'm hoping that it is less deadly this time. I mean, that's a small comfort, but it's something. You know, maybe the hospitals are more prepared. Maybe we don't need the shutdowns, but still, it's scary. So, Shep, let me ask you just one follow-up question. Again, I know you're going to be getting into this later, but if there is the ability for debate moderators to cut the mics of participants, that could also backfire in a big way on the moderators. This is tricky. I don't know.
It's all very tricky, but keep this in mind, Kelly. The next debate is a week from today, and that debate is a town hall-style debate, meaning that there'll be people who are asking their own questions, and a moderator will kind of keep the candidates working in a different sort of environment. You know, last night was chaotic. We've never seen anything like it, and we're going to try to put it into context tonight. We're not beginning tonight like an usual newscast might, because that was not a usual event. In addition, we're covering COVID, we're covering racial injustice, we're covering income disparagement, and further, we have a little segment every night from CNBC called On the Money, where we'll talk just briefly to a sort of general news audience about money and what's happening. And from time to time, Kelly, we're going to call out the shiny object. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times business leaders, politicians will give you a lot of look over here, when there's something important that they don't want you to notice. We're calling that our shiny object, and we'll point that out from time to time. It's a general news program bringing you the facts, the truth, the news every weeknight at 7 o'clock Eastern Time right here on CNBC, and I'm so excited.
Yeah, kind of old school like you described
it,
Shep. And I still remember when we talked to you a few weeks ago and said, what's on your mind today? And it was another day where you had COVID and you had stimulus talks and all this stuff out of D.C. And you said, water. I mean, the wildfires that we've given very little, attention to, because there's just so much else that's going on, right? I mean, that to me is what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, they haven't ended. The wildfires haven't ended. The recovery in Louisiana from two hurricanes ago has not ended. There are still people who need shelter. There are still people who are trying to escape COVID as they don't have a house to go to because it's flooded out or broken apart and on the ground. There's never been a news cycle. I've been doing this for 33 years. There's never been a news cycle like this. And it's really not about statistics.
Yeah.
It's about human beings. And a lot of them are suffering. And there are heroes amid that chaos. And we'll find them too, Kelly.
Yep, and you're the consummate storyteller as well. Shep, again, a pleasure to have you here. We look forward to tuning in tonight. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Kelly.
Tonight, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the debut of the news with Shepard Smith. As we go, a quick check on Palantir, just opened for trading a couple of moments ago, 55%. We'll have a whole lot more next hour, including an interview with Palantir CEO Alex Karp. We're very much looking forward to that. The share's just under 11 bucks right now. Stay with us.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.